Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jennifer Westaway in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. First, some facts. In 2001, Latinos became the fastest-growing minority group in America, 39 million strong and counting. Today, Hispanic Americans form 13% of the U.S. population. Another 50 years, and that number grows to a quarter of the country. Right now, 1 in 10 Americans is a Spanish speaker. And this is not a country within a country, says our guest tonight, but a people transforming a country. Latinos, he says, are changing the very definition of what it means to be American. Tonight, On Point, author Hector Tobar takes us inside the Spanish-speaking translation nation. But first, we begin in Iraq, where a commercial helicopter crash today killed 11 people, including 6 Americans. Also, over the past 2 months, around 60 corpses have been retrieved from the Tigris River south of Baghdad. Iraq's president, Jalal Talabani, said the bodies were those of murdered hostages. Most of the victims, according to the police, died of gunshot wounds. Patrick McDonald is Baghdad correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. I asked him if there was independent confirmation that these bodies were recovered from the Tigris River.
The only independent confirmations, per se, are police in the city of Suwayda, which is about 55 kilometers south of Baghdad, where a lot of the bodies have been showing up. And, you know, we got a reporter in there today, and it's pretty clear the bodies have been showing up. What seems to have really been happening is that these bodies have been showing up over a period of weeks. In truth, what authorities are saying is that people who were executed after being picked up, probably at insurgent checkpoints or insurgent operations in small villages in the Tigris River Valley south of Baghdad, which is a heavily contested area. It's mixed Sunni and Shiite, and the allegation of many of the Shiites who live there is that the Sunni Muslim guerrillas are trying to basically clear out the Shiite population there as much as possible. So like everything in Iraq, it's very, very difficult to ferret out the truth. And, you know, lamentably, the country is heading down this road of sectarianism in which just about anything that happens gets wrapped up in kind of a sectarian cloth. So Shiite politicians have jumped on the issue of these bodies to claim that there's been a mass slaughter going on. And it's not to say they're wrong, but it's clear that all of these victims were not picked up at once over the weekend, over a course of a few days, as was initially claimed. Indeed, they seem to have been showing up in the river for weeks, if not more than a month.
One of the things that President Talabani said was that the bodies had all been identified, as had the criminals who'd committed the crimes, and then he was promising to release details in the coming days. It all seemed a bit wrapped up and tied with a bow, and I'm wondering how much skepticism there is in terms of how the news of these bodies is being used.
There's no question that the news of these bodies is being used. And talking to the police today, it's clear they don't know the identities of many of the bodies. And I think the feeling is that only a minority have really been identified. Many of them seem to be unidentifiable. President Talabani made that statement. There's really no independent verification of his statement that all of the bodies have been identified and all of the perpetrators have been caught. Indeed, among the police, there's considerable skepticism that most of these perpetrators have been caught. The way this typically works in Iraq is several masked men stop a car on a road. They pull people out and often shoot them on the side of the road. It's a very difficult thing to trace masked men who are doing, you know, this kind of operation.
Is there an element to this of you know, stoking the fires of nationalism or ethnic tension? And there's something reminiscent of Bosnia in some of the claims being made these days.
Yeah, we're even hearing the phrase in Arabic now, ethnic cleansing among the Shiite population, Shiite politicians. That's what they essentially say has been going on in these villages south of Baghdad. And again, I think there is some exaggeration in that, but that's not to say some level of what they call ethnic cleansing is not going on. It has been going on for some time. It's a very, very contested area south of Baghdad, and there are many, many Saddam loyalists, There are villages there that are Sunni majority, villages there that are Shiite majority, and, you know, one of the unfortunate things that has happened in the past 2 years is that these sectarian divisions have become very, very much more pronounced, particularly now that we have a Shiite majority government about to take office.
And this all comes, too, at a time when they're negotiating the power sharing of that government, and I'm wondering how significant that is.
I think it's quite significant. The Sunni Muslim population, the Sunni Arab population, is extremely worried. As you know, their turnout in the election was very small. They're not nearly represented in the new transitional National Assembly, commensurate with their population. And they're very, very concerned about being shut out of a government in a country that they've dominated for generations. That's kind of an overarching backdrop to this whole body drama that's been unfolding.
There's been other news in the last few days of ratcheting up in some of the insurgent activity. We just heard about another attempt on interim Prime Minister Alawi's life, and there's a downing of another helicopter. This one actually shot down, not an accident. Has there been in the last couple of weeks, to your eyes, stepping up of these attacks?
In the last week, certainly. I mean, I think there have been more than 10, maybe as many as 20 suicide bombs in the Baghdad area, suicide car bombs. Yesterday we had explosions seemingly going off all day around the city. There's the shoot down of the helicopter. There have been several successful attacks on Western convoys going down the airport road. I mean, it seems clear after a period of relative calm, and it's clear talking to Iraqis, that people are pretty rattled about what seems to be a ratcheting up in violence. And we're back to a situation, you know, in January where people were saying, I heard somebody tell me today, you know, they're everywhere, referring to the guerrillas, the insurgents, and it didn't seem that way for a period of time, but many people in Iraq feel that again because of this ratcheting up of violence.
Any speculation as to why the timing of it now?
There's a lot of speculation, but one thing we've learned here, having been here for a while, is that trying to read into the guerrilla strategy has been very, very difficult. The way they've worked is that there's been spikes of violence and troughs when it hasn't been as violent. There's speculation that they're getting rearmed, they're repositioning, replanning. There were some very heavy government operations that took in a lot of suspected insurgents right around the time of the election and the election aftermath. Perhaps they've had time to rearm, reposition. Perhaps they wanted to make a big splash before the new government takes office. Perhaps this ratcheting up has nothing to do with either of those. We really don't know. We don't talk to the insurgents. I mean, they put things on, supposedly things on websites, but it's really very, very hard to know what motivates the ebb and flow of their activities. But they have once again proved that they can be a very devastating force.
Thank you for joining us tonight.
My pleasure.
Patrick McDonald is Iraq correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. He spoke with us from Baghdad. Look around and you'll see the influence of America's growing Latin American community everywhere. Beyond the supermarket salsa, the fast food burritos, and the Ricky Martin music, our guest tonight, Pulitzer Prize-winning author Hector Tobar, says the United States' fastest-growing minority is changing what it means to be American. It's molding a new national culture. He calls it the Latin Republic of the United States. So Hector Tobar took a page from de Tocqueville and set off on a journey into this new Latino-influenced America, the Translation Nation, he calls it. Tobar started with his own family, his own Guatemalan parents, in his own city, Los Angeles, the place he calls America's 21st century cultural crucible. From there, he went to Georgia, Idaho, Michigan, and Kansas. He found a new America. This hour on Point, Hector Tobar and Latinos in America, the challenges of immigration, integration, and transformation in Translation Nation. You can join the conversation. Is Latino immigration changing America? Have you seen its impact in your city, in your town? Latino Americans, are you a citizen of Hector Tobar's Translation Nation? Do you feel like you're changing America? Or is maybe it changing you? Join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Los Angeles is Hector Tobar, former Latino affairs correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. In 1992, he was part of the Pulitzer Prize-winning writing team that covered the L.A. riots and is now Buenos Aires bureau chief for the L.A. Times. His new book is Translation Nation, Defining a New American Identity in the Spanish-Speaking United States. Hector, hola.
Hola, ¿qué tal? ¿Cómo estás?
Oh, I knew you were going to do that.
You did it first.
That was the extent of my Spanish, unless you want to ask yourself questions for the next little while. While I was reading your book, I found myself recognizing these little points of change that I hadn't really appreciated as part of the bigger whole. I mean, for example, taking your dog for a walk to the park every Saturday morning, and then suddenly one Saturday getting there and the park being filled with a soccer game and everyone running around screaming and laughing in Spanish and looking totally at home, and yet they hadn't been there a week ago. And it speaks to the speed of change and the difference in Latino immigration. And I'm wondering what differences you see from this wave compared to waves past.
Well, I think it's the permanence and the replenishing, you know, that's taking place. I think you can measure Italian immigration and its impact on the United States, and it's a phenomenon that began in the 19th century and lasted in terms of millions for the first few decades of the 20th century, and then it stopped. You know, I mean, it stopped being that transformative phenomenon for American culture. I mean, I think Italian immigration, you look at a city like New York, it transformed New York, and then Little Italy was reproduced all across the United States. Mm-hmm. What I think has happened with Latino immigration is that it has sort of now become a constant source of replenishing of people into the society. Latin America is transporting its most ambitious people, sometimes its most desperate people, its dreamers northward, and they just, you know, they do keep arriving because there is now, not only is there the job, there's also the network of friends, there's the soccer league, there's the community to arrive to, and that's a tremendous draw for people.
It also seems that once here, they don't disappear as immigration's past may have done.
Well, yeah.
They aren't absorbed into the melting pot, I guess is what I mean.
Well, I think in general, you know, the engine of American assimilation, you know, has wound down. And what has happened now is that in several American cities, there are, you know, well-established Latino institutions. I mean, the first one really that you often see in a small town is the soccer league.
I'm going to have to pause right there. We're going to take a short break. We're talking tonight with Hector Tobar, taking a journey inside Spanish-speaking America. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Jennifer Westaway in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Jennifer Westaway in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking tonight about booming growth and looming influence of Spanish-speaking Americans in the United States. You can join the conversation. Where do you see the power and energy of Hispanic Americans in the United States today? Are they integrating into American society, changing it? Latino Americans, what has your experience been like? Has it been easy or hard? And what's the story from Latin-influenced American life? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined tonight from Los Angeles by Hector Tobar, author of the new book, Translation Nation, Defining a New American Identity in the Spanish-speaking United States. Hector, tell me a bit about your experience growing up. Your own parents came from Guatemala. Were you a typical child of immigrants in L.A.?
Well, I think I was for the time. You know, it was a time of great hope in California. It was the time of the space age and, you know, all the industries that were based here that were part of just that great boom, you know, in American history. And it was a time when California public schools were, you know, considered to be the best in the United States. And I think I grew up with a pretty typical, you know, American childhood. You know, I learned the Gettysburg Address. I carried the flag in the 4th of July parade. And the school was really still had that model of integrating me into American culture. And I loved it. I mean, I loved American history. I loved learning about the Civil War. But I'd go home and I'd get the story of, you know, the other half of my history, you know, that I was Latin American, that my family is from Guatemala. My father insisted that I speak Spanish to him in the home. And in that way, I think he was kind of different from your average Latin American immigrant of his generation when people wanted to assimilate. My father was extremely proud of being a Guatemalteco. He would tell me stories of the coup in 1954 in which he said the CIA overthrew the Guatemalan government. So I would get sort of this subversive history at home. My father would talk to me about Che Guevara and, you know, this gorilla in the mountains. And I was I was little enough then that I didn't know what, if it, you know, I thought a gorilla was like a monkey, you know, it was like a chimpanzee in the mountain. So I thought Che was swinging from the trees, you know, fighting the bad guys. And then at school, you know, I would, you know, learn American, about American history and American civic institutions, and want it. And I really firmly believed that if I got straight A's in school and if I ascended to the top of the class as a good American student, that good things would come for me and my family, and that I would be a full citizen. You know, so I sort of grew up with those two ideas.
You mentioned that your father, of course, brought with him from Guatemala his memories of the CIA operations there. And I'm wondering about the ambivalence of a lot of Latinos towards their American identity, and how much that has to do with some of the baggage that they bring with them and America's behavior in their home countries.
Well, yeah, even beyond politics, I think that they're, you know, if you are someone living in Latin America and you embrace the notion that there's this richer, smarter country to the north, if you really embrace that idea, you're embracing an inferiority complex. You know, you're going to feel bad about yourself. So I think naturally people have this idea that, no, you know, we have a history of being an oppressed people. And I think that that story is passed down in many different kinds of ways. It's passed down, you know, when people talk about political history, it's passed down when people talk about personal histories, what we went through when we came to this country, the way, you know, people wouldn't, no nos atendían en la tienda, they wouldn't, you know, speak to us in the store because we look different. And so people have this personal history that is, in a sense, a story of resistance. And that, I think, is what keeps people's sort of cultural identity alive, you know, in those first few years of arriving in a new country.
Now, the LA of today is very different from the LA that you grew up in. And you talk in your book about that city east of La Cienega Boulevard. You describe the whole city, actually, as I mentioned earlier, as a crucible, a kind of a gateway to the rest of the United States, and draw a parallel between it and New York City in the 20th century. Talk a little bit more about that.
Well, you know, in the L.A. that I grew up in the 1960s, the Latino community was a barrio. It was a ghetto. Barrio is a Spanish word that means ghetto. And it was a little corner of the city where, you know, there was Mexican food and people talk Spanish, you know. When I became a reporter for the L.A. Times in the late 1980s, the city was on the cusp of this incredible cultural transformation. And what was happening was that the number of Latinos in the city had grown, mostly immigration from Mexico and from Central America. It had grown to such an extent that suddenly the pull of Latino culture became strong. People started reverse assimilating. You know, people who didn't speak Spanish as children wanted now as adults to learn Spanish.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a really, really marked growth of Latino civic institutions of all kinds, of all, you know, from the soccer leagues to the, you know, the village sort of solidarity societies, where a bunch of neighbors in, let's say, Compton would raise money to send to the village down in, you know, Guanajuato or Jalisco. So there was this flowering of, you know, of institutions. And I saw that as, you know, as something as exclusively Los Angeles phenomenon. You know, this is something that I covered as a Metro reporter for several years. And then I was lucky enough in the mid-90s to get a job, in the late 90s, to get a job as the Latino National Affairs correspondent. And I was able to travel into the interior of the United States. And I would see that soccer league that I saw in the San Fernando Valley suddenly reproduced in Dalton, Georgia. In fact, it turns out that the guy who's helped start the soccer league in Dalton, Georgia, is expatriate Angelino, if I could use that term. He's someone a Mexican who migrated to L.A. and then migrated to Georgia. And in a similar vein, Dalton had its Spanish language newspaper, which was like La Opinión in Los Angeles, reporting about not just about the community news and about the problems people had with immigration, but also about Shakira and the Mexican soccer league. So it was this little world that I had seen growing in, you know, in Los Angeles into this citywide culture suddenly reproducing itself. And even, you know, things like the gang phenomenon, which you see now in towns in Kansas and Georgia, where there are Los Angeles street gangs, at least the names of Los Angeles street gangs, mm-hmm. or Salvadoran street gangs that have been exported to these towns in the Midwest, and the local police officers have to call Los Angeles and say, hey, what do these signs mean? What are these marks on the wall mean?
How do we
and,
read
you know,
this graffiti?
I want to
go to the phones here, Hector. We have a call from Lexington, Kentucky. Sarah, welcome to the program.
Hi, it's good to be on.
You have a comment for our guest.
Yeah, I was going to say, I moved to Lexington, Kentucky in 1967 from California, and we brought with us a Mexicana, daughter of a bracero. We could not find anyone in Lexington who spoke Spanish for her to speak with. There was absolutely no Latin culture here. And she eventually went home. Now we have a bilingual library. We have a strong Latino population who are beginning to be accepted. We have Spanish immersion schools. We have, thank God, we have real Mexican restaurants. So this is a very
the quality of the enchiladas has improved dramatically.
It's improved tremendously, and this is not a rapidly moving place. We've only just discovered bike lanes and organic gardening, and yet we do have a wonderful Latin presence here now.
And this is in Lexington, Kentucky.
Kentucky.
What would have started it there?
It's agriculture.
Okay.
Just
tobacco.
As opposed to California.
Right. Right. Well, you know, one thing I noticed going to places, I've not gone to Lexington, Kentucky, but I've been to Chattanooga, Tennessee, and Memphis, and Dalton, Georgia, and Clay County, Alabama, which are in the rough sort of general area, is that when I went there the first time, those places for the first time, it felt a lot like Los Angeles in the 1960s. You know, the local population was still really enthused about having these hardworking families, you know, arriving in their town and wanted to take care of them. Dalton had invested, you know, thousands of dollars per pupil, you know, to make sure that there were bilingual teachers. They sent their teachers to Mexico to study so they could learn the culture of the people who were arriving in town. And so I really felt that in my book, that chapter about the South is called In the Land of the New, because everything felt so new. Everything felt like, oh, we're just discovering who these people are. And, you know, there hadn't been time to accumulate yet, you know, a lot of the baggage that you'll find in a southwestern city, you know, or in Miami or some other place.
Can I ask you, Hector, about your time as your underground disguise? I was really intrigued by this time you spent in a chicken plant working for Tyson. How did you manage to get hired on as one of the workers?
Well, I went to the U.S.-Mexico border to McAllen, Texas, and there are hiring halls that recruit workers, either local people who live on the border towns or mostly, you know, Mexican immigrants who've, you know, come across the Rio Grande. And they are basically supplying labor for all the poultry plants, the meat processing plants in the inner United States. So I went to this place in McAllen and just dressed in a T-shirt and jeans. And I looked like your average, you know, Mexican-American. I had a little hat embroidered with my name Hector in the old English script, you know, and I spoke English because a lot of the workers there, you know, are bilingual and, you know, they're, you know, Mexican Americans. And so I got hired and I got on I did not know where I was going until he gave me the bus ticket and it said Anniston, Alabama. And I found out that I was going to go work for Tyson Chicken in Clay County, Alabama, specifically in their Ashland processing plant.
I have to say, and it seems you were treated a little better than I expected. I expected this to be something of a horror story and it wasn't.
Well, I think that at that time, they really needed the workers. And I think they still do. They need the labor. And so, you know, they don't want to lose people. They want to hold on to them for a while, at least for a few months. I think, you know, turnover of a labor force is bad in any industry. And they actually did treat us pretty well. I mean, you know, we were put up in a trailer park, in Clay County. And I lived with about maybe 30, 40 other people, and they even gave us satellite television. we were out in the middle of nowhere. I mean, it was about a mile walk to the nearest telephone. We didn't really have anywhere to shop, and so they would bring the bus out to our, you know, trailer park once a week to go take a shopping at the Piggly Wiggly, in Ashland.
And you were able to revisit Ashland and the Anniston area a few years later, and there's a really interesting difference between when you were there as a worker and what happened to some of the workers who were on the line with you in those few years.
Well, you know, it's a place that it's like it's a landing pad kind of place, I think. You know, I think there's a lot of communities like that all throughout the United States where you arrive as an immigrant, you establish yourself. It's the very, you know, entry level, you know, job in the American workforce, you know. Chicken processor, you know, with a knife. It's the lowest, it's one of the toughest jobs you can have, you know, for not really great pay. And so once people get established, they move on to the furniture factories. There's lots of furniture factories in that part of the country. A lot of, you know, they pay a little bit better. They might have benefits. And so people move on. But in spite of that, in spite of the transitory nature of that kind of work, there was a community settling down. And when I went back, I went to the new Catholic Church, one of the newest Catholic churches in northern Alabama, if not the newest one, and went to Mass. And I felt really a community that had established itself. And I was also surprised to discover that there were not just Mexican immigrants there. There was also Guatemalans. There were Panamanians. There were Cubans. There were a couple of guys who had, you know, spent time in detention in Guantanamo because they had tried to cross, you know, as rafters, and somehow or another been recruited to go work in this, you know, town in Alabama. And so,
they found Clay the welcoming County, route.
they did. It was really this little pan-Latino community that had been created in the Baptist Belt. I mean, this is a very, very deeply religious, the reddest red state you can find is, I think, northern Alabama.
I'd like to go back to the phones. We have a call from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Joaquin, welcome
Hi.
To On Point.
Thank you for taking my call. I had a question for Mr. Tovar about the divisions that I perceive, like in the Latino community, for example, in comparison to the Black community, divisions that have to do both with regional areas and also class lines. It seems to me that there's such a thing as the United Negro College Fund and other initiatives where the Black bourgeoisie really contributes to the community. And I don't really see that much of that in my Latino community. And also, of course, the divisions that I've mentioned, the regional divisions, Puerto Ricans with Mexicans, Guatemalans, people from Cuba, that they don't really seem to coalesce. And we don't get something like the civil rights movement Not only are we not united among ourselves, but we don't seem to find a language with which to speak, a common language to speak with the mainstream as to political issues, like the Blacks did with civic issues, religious issues. I wonder if you could talk about, that kind of fracturing of the community and what solutions you might see for overcoming that.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. I think it's because people who come from vastly different political and cultural traditions. Mexican immigration is mostly a rural phenomenon, and you're talking about people who come from the countryside, and they tend to be more culturally conservative. They fit in really well in places like Georgia and Tennessee because they tend to have sort of a down-home outlook. They don't want to really sort of ruffle too many feathers and whatnot. And then you have your sort of, your urban Central Americans and urban Mexicans who tend to come from a place where there's like this, really strong rhetoric of class struggle, and they have their agenda, And then you have the Caribbean phenomenon, the Cuban and the Puerto Rican, which is, also vastly different. I argue in my book that I see sort of that these communities are developing common strands. The Cuban migration phenomenon has become more like the Mexican migration phenomenon because, people are no longer allowed to come. I mean, if you come in a boat, and you're caught in the middle of the straits of Florida, you are deported, just as if you're caught in the Sonora Desert trying to sneak into the United States, you're also deported. So in a certain sense, the Cuban migration is now being treated like the Mexican migration is in terms of, the legal aspects.
Right, and the legals and illegals. I'm Jennifer Westaway. This is On Point. I just wanted to bring up a point here, Hector. We're talking about a lot of the sort of positive aspects of Latino immigration, but Of course there's been, because it's happened perhaps so fast and in such numbers, there's also been a backlash. Things like English-only laws, they're not solely targeted at the Spanish language, but certainly that's a part of it. And we had some volunteer groups popping up on the borders, the Minutemen helping with the border patrols. What do these kinds of things how do you think these kinds of things are being interpreted by the Latino community?
I think that it reinforces the general sense among the most recently arrived immigrants that we're not wanted, that we're a subclass, that we don't have any rights, And I think that's a very dangerous thing because we are at risk of creating an underclass of millions of people who, live in the United States and pay taxes and yet do not have any civil rights. That's a very, very dangerous situation for any society.
Well, you saw some of that in the L.A. riots, did you not?
Well, exactly. I describe it in my book as sort of the first Latin American caste uprising in United States history. You know, it was the people who sort of felt tired of working for a minimum wage, tired of the fact that their employer could cheat them out of their money anytime they wanted to and fire them because they had no recourse to go to court. You know, people just sort of frustrated with, you know, people who felt cheated by Los Angeles because it was supposed to be this land of milk and honey, and it turned out to be a land of, you know, $4 an hour and rents you can't pay. And I think there is a sense I have one of the things that I fear is that the United States, parts of the United States, have become like a Latin American country in the sense of the political culture, you know, gradually becoming more class and more caste driven, you know, more rigid. Mm-hmm. And that's my fear.
We're talking tonight with Hector Tovar, taking a journey inside Spanish-speaking America and looking at how Latino Americans are transforming the United States. You can join the conversation. What do you hear in Hector Tovar's stories of Latino immigrants? Is this wave of stories the same as it was 100 years ago or different? And what do you make of Tovar's claim of a new Latino American transnational identity? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Jennifer Westaway, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Jennifer Westaway, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about Latino influence in the United States, and we're journeying through Spanish-speaking America tonight with Pulitzer Prize-winning author Hector Tovar. You can join the conversation. With 10% of Americans already speaking Spanish, is English in danger? Latinos, what's your view of the constant coverage of things like legal and illegal immigration at U.S. borders? Do you have an American story to tell us? What do you think lies ahead for Latinos in America in the 21st century? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined tonight from Los Angeles by Hector Tovar, author of the new book Translation Nation, Defining a New American Identity in the Spanish-Speaking United States. I'd like to go back to the phones. We have a call from Asheboro, North Carolina. Javier, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Do you have a comment for Hector Tovar?
Yeah, first of all, I just want to say, ¿cómo estás vos? ¿Cómo te va? I am from Guatemala.
Sos guatemalteco. Sos chapín.
Oh, now you too.
Well, the nice thing about it is it's really interesting, and I was saying when somebody will get the phone call before that, when I wasn't here, first of all, I just got here 2 years ago, so which is totally different as your experience, but what I have to tell you is I feel that when you see things over there in our country, you think that a Latino is not really a big thing here. It's just a minority, and not many people speak Spanish. You're going to have a problem. If you had to leave just Los Angeles or Chicago to find people from Guatemala, first of all, that's not true at all. You can find people from everywhere, and this is the nice thing. And I hear something about kind of comment that if the in English language would be in danger because people, you know, is speaking Spanish more and more and more, and I don't think so.
What?
I have
so
to take the ESL classes because I didn't have the English I have now. But the nice thing about it is my teacher told me that it's just something that's going to mix. You're going to create a new language, and you're going to create a new culture, you know, bilingual culture, or if you want to call it Spanglish culture,
right,
or stuff like that. You know, it is really great because it's, before maybe we see each other like, you know, not really friendly, but now it's just something and it's growing and we have to accept it. You know, the world is coming, it's coming smaller and smaller because
you can
go everywhere and speak any language. It's so easy now.
Yeah, Hector, what do you make of Javier's comment there that he didn't expect to find as much Spanish as he did in Asheboro, North Carolina? It sounds like it isn't just the non-Latino community that's been taken by surprise.
Well, you know, I'll tell you a story about Guatemalans in the South. A few weeks ago, or maybe about a month ago, the Guatemalan national soccer team played a World Cup qualifier for the FIFA Soccer World Cup in Birmingham, Alabama. and the United States Soccer Federation. And I'm a fan of the U.S. soccer team and the Guatemalan soccer team. I've really been a fan for the U.S. soccer team since I was a little kid. But, you know, they played, the United States Soccer Federation wanted to play this game in Birmingham because they figured it would be a pro-U.S. crowd because they look at the map and, you know, how could we get 10,000 Guatemalans there? It's impossible. Uh-huh. And in fact, when the game began, there were, you know, almost as many, actually there were probably more Guatemalans according to some of the news reports I've seen than there were American fans, and with signs, you know, Guatemalan community of Memphis, Tennessee, or Guatemalan community of Chicago, and what, you know, so people had come from all around to go see the soccer game. So, you know, when I was growing up in Hollywood in California, I mean, I knew two or three Guatemalan families we knew, and now, you know, this phenomenon has spread throughout the entire country.
We're going to take another call now from Nina, Wisconsin. Marcelo, welcome.
Hola.
Hola.
Thank you for taking the call.
Hola, ¿qué tal?
Hector, I just want to ask you something. You are you were born here in the United States. I wasn't. I came from Ecuador. What do you think is the relationship between the first to second generation of Latinos born here and the new arrivals?
Well, I think it's really evolved. I think that before the first generation, the second generation turned its back more on the new arrivals, you know, or at least they turned their back on the culture of the new arrivals. You had just come from Ecuador, you'd come from Guatemala, you were going to become an American now, and forget about Quito, forget about Guayaquil, forget about Guatemala City, you know, you have to learn now how things operate in Madison, you know. Whereas now, I think that the person who comes is sort of seen more as an equal, you know. Oh, I was in your position, you know, 10 years ago, compadre. You know, the person who has, that, from that first or second generation, is no longer turning his back, you know, on that generation that came, that is now coming, you know. So I think that is, I think, the chief difference, you know, that I see. And I think, and I see more and more institutions being created by those established for those newly arrived. The caller from Massachusetts who said that he had not yet seen those institutions being created as the black community had. Well, I think if you just give it time, you know, in Los Angeles, California, in the late 1980s, early 1990s, I covered South Los Angeles, about a black community that was becoming Latino. There were a million Latinos who did not have a single civic organization. I saw the birth of the first one, and I wrote about it, and now there are dozens of civic organizations. There are dozens of city council members in southeast Los Angeles County now of Latino descent, whereas just a generation ago, they were hard. You can count them on one hand. So I think if you give it time, those communities will grow, and I think there is a certain sort of, you know, symbiosis going on between the generations now because it's sort of seen as something you really don't turn your back on. Your Guatemalteco-ness or your Ecuadorian-ness or your South American-ness is something that you want to pass on to your children more than, say, 20 years ago or 30 years ago.
Yeah, you refer a few times in your book to writer Samuel Huntington. And his writing, he takes the view that American values are threatened by immigrants who don't assimilate. How do you view his take on immigration?
Well, what I see is that American institutions are being replenished and transformed. You know, the aspiration of a good chunk of the Latino community in Dalton, Georgia, which is now a majority in Dalton, is to have their first city council member. They want to be like a Massachusetts township that Tocqueville described. They want to join together and find political representation. They want to be part of the system. They want to be able to have their kids go to community college, which in some cases they can't, because if you're not a legal U.S. resident in some states, you can't go to college. You can't go to a university. They want to be included. However, at the same time, they are bringing their Latin American values and traditions. They are bringing a sense of their Latin American selves. I think that one day, the history textbooks in Georgia and Alabama and in California are going to have chapters on Latin American history and how Latin American history and U.S. history are related, you know, to one another, because that history is being brought, you know. And I think in a certain sense, Huntington is right, because people are bringing their Latin American values, their way of doing politics, their suspicions, their prejudices sometimes. I describe this in my book, some of the small town politics in suburban Los Angeles County, where people act as if it's a Mexican town. And, you know, they act as if it's the caudillo, the strong person, the mayor is the strong person, and you have to sort of rebel against them or you have to be on their side. And there's all these, you know, sorts of little petty corruption that goes on and mobilization. So I think it's a dual process. I think it's a process where people really want to be fit into these institutions. They want to have city council members. They want to take the oath as American citizens. But at the same time, they want to be able to say, I am a person who comes from this place
this
to the South.
This is my
and
heritage.
This is me.
Yeah.
Yes, exactly.
Let's take another call here from Boston, Massachusetts. Fahal, welcome to On Point.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Do you have a comment for Hector Tovar?
Yes, I do. It's a question, but let me first say that I, having lived in Boston and D.C., I am very, very amazed by the vibrant Latino culture. The food is delicious. The women are beautiful. It really is something to cherish. And Americans are very lucky to have such a community within them. One question is the following. I think the common denominator that the early immigrants had with the first settlers is that they were all white. And what the Latinos have in common with the rest of America is that they are Christian. Now, would the situation be the same, let's say, that if this was a Hindu or a Muslim community, let's say that you did not have that religious if you didn't have religion in common.
It's an interesting question, Hector.
Well, what you're describing is Europe. You're describing France. You're describing Spain and Germany, where the big immigration is from the Middle East and people are Muslims. That's what you're describing. I think that's the question to ask the person who writes Translation Nation in France, you know. but I think that there's an important difference because the political culture, for example, Samuel Huntington talks about this. The political culture of the United States is based on white Anglo-Saxon Protestant values, you know, and Latino culture is very Catholic. And, you know, the whole Catholic mindset is different from the Protestant mindset. You know, I mean, there's, you know, I mean, I see this, you know, we have a whole different relationship with guilt, for example, you know. And so I think that it is true that there are some common denominators that allow some, you know, assimilation of those values. I think you can really see it in the growth of the Catholic Church. The Catholic Church in, let's say, New York or Georgia, the seeds that were planted by the Italians and the Irish in one century are now sort of being, you know, taken up by the Mexicans and the Guatemalans and the you know, Cubans in another century.
Being,
you know,
picked
so you
up
have
and nurtured.
Exactly, exactly.
I'm Jennifer Westaway. This is On Point. I'd like to go back to the phones here. We have another call. This is from Durham, North Carolina. Nate, welcome to On Point. Nate, are you there?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes, you're coming in loud and clear.
Yes, Nate.
Good. Which is surprising for a cell phone. At any rate, thank you for taking my call. I've been listening to your show as I've been driving in from Virginia. And I find that the gentleman is doing something of a miscarriage of justice, if you will. He talks about people, rights, and people migrating to this country. I happen to be first generation, although I don't sound it. My parents are people who were from the ghettos and the concentration camps of Europe. There was a format by which people came here. Sponsorship,
right,
to getting jobs, working towards citizenship.
Do you have a question for Hector, Nate?
He would own up to the fact that the people who run the Hispanic community should be the first ones in the forefront to admit and ask for a visitor program for these people who are coming in illegally for whatever their reasons are, and they're needed in this country. And yes, in most cases, they are paying taxes that are phantom that they'll never see and benefits that they'll never get. I don't see that from your community. I don't see you getting together and saying, because we are at war. We are in a situation where it could be other folks are coming in who are not coming here for economic reason or for other or political reasons.
Okay, Nate, I'd like to give Hector a chance to address your comment.
Well, I think that Latino community leaders across the United States, in every state that there is a sizable Latino community, if you would ask them, they would say that, yes, we want an amnesty program. Yes, we want a legalization program. Yes, we would love to have a quota where, you know, hundreds of thousands of people from Mexico and Guatemala would be allowed to work and take these low-paying jobs that nobody else wants. But the political realities of this country are that non-Latinos are not going to vote for that. It's just not going to happen. So, and you have this mass of people south of the border who are desperate or who live in a society where there isn't social mobility, where there isn't a way to escape your status in life, and they see this place where there is opportunity. And I think that if that Latino community in the United States had enough political clout to push that through, that would be one of the first things that they would do. And there was, in fact, before September 11th, a move to push through another amnesty program. Now, because September 11th happened and because the men who did that were people who had, you know, who had come in on visas as immigrants, there was a backlash against immigrants in general. And so all of those attempts to pass those laws that would have brought, you know, a little bit more order to this process by which, you know, people from Latin America come to the United States, those measures were set back by a decade at least.
Right. There was a significant mood change in
exactly.
Just our thinking about borders. Speaking of 9/11, though, that brings us forward to things like the war in Iraq. I wanted you to touch on just briefly, while we have a couple of minutes left here, the Green Card Marines. Who are they, and why do we call them that?
These are young men and women who have status as legal residents, but not permanent status. Not citizenship. And if you go and you serve in the U.S. Armed Forces and you serve your country, even though it's not really your country, you can get your papers. You can get your, you know, U.S. citizenship. And so there are a number of young men and women who have done this, and many of them have died in service of the United States of America, including one young man who was a friend of my family, a friend of my father, who I mentioned in the book, who was one of, I think, the second U.S. Marine killed in the invasion of Iraq. And it's there are stories that are fraught with so many ironies, because the one man that I describe in my book was someone who crossed the border illegally on a train into the United States, lived in the United States as an illegal, as an undocumented immigrant. Eventually joined the Marines, and when he died, he was buried in Guatemala with a Marine Corps guard over his grave in Guatemala City, and he had been an orphan. And his funeral was one of at least a dozen or more of young men in similar situations who were buried, with full honors, but very often with their, relatives singing the Mexican national anthem as they were buried. These are people who wanted as your caller in North Carolina, they wanted to do the right thing. They wanted to, they wanted to give something to this country that had accepted them, a country that they had grown to love for the opportunity it gave to them, and who died in the line of battle.
And some of whom became American citizens after their death.
Exactly. They became Americans posthumously.
Right. Hector, thank you so much for joining us this evening.
Thank you so much for having me, Jennifer.
Hector Tobar is the Pulitzer Prize-winning writer and the Buenos Aires Bureau Chief for the Los Angeles Times. His book is called Translation Nation, Defining a New American Identity in the Spanish-Speaking United States. You can continue the conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. I'm Jennifer Westaway, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.